everyone. This is Cartoons to Castles,
the history behind the mouse and magic. I'm Melanie.
And I'm Jessica. We're best friends and Disney nerds who wanted to learn more about the history behind the Walt Disney Company's movies, shows, music, theme parks, and more, and share it all with you.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode.
All right. Well, welcome back, everyone, to our first episode of 2021.
Yes.
Yes. We are super excited to be back after our little winter break.
And we are going to read some new reviews to start out.
Yeah. Melanie, do you want to kick us off?
I will. So this review is from Joe Smash, who says, I love, love, love these ladies. You can tell they not only love what they are talking about, but they do their homework. They have great, knowledgeable guests, and best of all, they are simply a delight to listen to. You can really tell that they genuinely enjoy each other's company. That's true. I love Jess's company.
Same to you. And the next review that I have to read is from Sarah Loves 3. I love listening to these podcasts. Each episode is always a happy surprise and filled with incredible content and guests. I have been especially impressed with the caliber of guests on the podcast, and I know that all Disney enthusiasts will find each episode interesting and enriching. The hosts, Jessica and Melanie, are absolutely delightful, and they present substantial content in a warm and captivating manner. This twosome are fun hosts, and they are obvious aficionados about everything Disney. Tune in so that you can be a part of this winning and informative Disney experience. Well, thank you guys so much for the kind words and reviews. And as we've mentioned, those reviews on Apple Podcasts are super helpful with our rankings so new people can discover us. So they're always appreciated.
And now moving on to the episode, which we're very excited about. So go ahead, Jess.
Today, we have a former Imagineer joining us to talk about his work on an attraction that actually just celebrated its 34th anniversary on January 9th. Star Tours.
Star Tours. He retired in 2016 from his position as a principal concept designer at Walt Disney Imagineering, and he also acted as the concept designer and art director for Shanghai Disneyland's Gardens of Imagination, as well as the art director for the 2010 upgrade of Tokyo Disneyland's Monsters, Inc. Ride and Go Seek attraction.
He was also the art director for Monsters, Inc., Mike and Sully to the Rescue at Disney California Adventure, which is a personal favorite of mine because my very first job was working on that attraction. Lots of experience on that one. As well as the lead designer for Grizzly River Run and Redwood Creek Challenge Trail at Disney California Adventure Park, and led the design effort on Typhoon Lagoon at Walt Disney World Resort.
He created numerous characters for Star Tours, including pilot droid RX-24, aka Rex, which we are here to talk about today.
Please welcome Chris Runko.
Hello.
Welcome, Chris. Thank you so much.
Nice to talk with you.
Yes, we are so thrilled that you are here with us. And the day after Star Tours anniversary, which was unintentional, we just realized, hey, this actually worked out pretty well.
Synchronicity.
Yes.
So speaking of Star Tours, since our focus for today's episode will be to talk to Chris about his firsthand experiences working on Star Tours, we also want to give some basic background information on the attraction and share a little bit about Star Tours' beginnings. So it opened on January 9th, 1987, with the final cost being approximately $32 million, about twice as much as the cost of constructing Disneyland in 1955. Mm-hmm.
Part of that cost was purchasing 4 military flight simulators for about $500,000 each for the attraction. George Lucas and Industrial Light and Magic produced the film we see in Star Tours. An Imagineering team then programmed the flight simulators to exactly match and enhance the camera motion of the film.
Once the ride was open to guests, the pilot on the Star Speeder 3000 was a droid named RX-24, or Rex, which Chris designed from concept to final production.
Now, Chris, we want to hear all of the stories about Rex, but can you first tell us a bit about how you began at Walt Disney Imagineering?
I grew up in La Habra, California, and went for a summer job. I went for a summer job like many people did at Disneyland. And in applying, they noticed that I had done caricatures before. So they asked me if instead of being a write up red, I might like to do portraits on Main Street. And I said, sure, why not? You know? So for all the years I was in college, I was working on Main Street, doing portraits of people. Then after college, I, was looking for, well, I was still working there, but only weekends. And I looked for something more steady and found a job at another little Disney company nearby that worked on the shooting galleries at the park. And while I was there, I met several people who had come down from Imagineering to help those folks kind of organize themselves. And they said, after we'd worked together for a while, they said, you should come to Imagineering, and we think you'd be good there. So I'd never heard of it. At that point, I didn't know what it was. So a few months later, I did apply for a job there. And they told me, well, we're actually building up. We have a big project coming called Epcot. And we're starting to add people. So we'll put you on the list. And so I was lucky enough to get hired into the model shop at Imagineering, where I worked for several years. And found out what it was. which was a truly amazing place. I loved the people I worked with, and it was incredible. I say I'm very, very lucky because I'm sort of second generation Imagineer in that I got to work with the first generation. I got to work with Claude Coates and Ken Anderson and Mark Davis and Marty Sklar and Orlando Ferrani, and the list goes on. These amazing people that built that phenomenal park, which is still, a standard for the whole industry today. Right. And then, worked through several generations till to the point we are now. We're probably on about the fourth or fifth generation of Imagineers. And I think all of us in that group feel like we have a certain responsibility to connect the dots, to tell people about the roots of the place and how it formed. Anyway, so that put me in the model shop. I worked on Epcot stuff. And then somewhere along the line, and I got to do a rehab of the subride. They saw some art director potential in me. So they sent me down to Disneyland to do a rehab of the subride, which at the time we tried to do a wet rehab. We didn't take the water out. We just put stuff in.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's the only time they did it. So that tells you how successful it was.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds a bit tricky.
Yeah, it was a little tricky because you need to usually paint everything, and we didn't get to do that. But I had this, not to digress too much, but it was, in hindsight, it was amazing because what I had to do was I would go out. They would park the submarine out in the ride. I would row out on a boat to the submarine, climb on board, go down, look out through the porthole, and then try and talk over the two-way mic to the the guys who were installing fish and seaweed and stuff. And I'd literally do this in the porthole, like waving them back a little right. Okay, nail it down there. And the microphones were useless at the time. They were just terrible. I would do sketches and stick them in the porthole. Like, I want three fish on that rock. So I'd draw a little sketch of the fish and three rocks and hold it up the porthole. And the diver would come up and squint and go, okay. And you go... Yeah, it's like it's the only time we ever tried that.
That's
without taking
that's
the water
amazing.
Out. So and best of all, we finished it off. The guys they razzed me as the art director, but we got to be friends. And the very last day we were working, they took me on a guided tour, walking tour of the subride. They put me in a wetsuit and gave me a scuba set, and we put our tennis shoes on and we climbed in back at the sub dock. And we walked the whole ride, which was, how many people in their lives ever get to do that? That was,
that was quite remarkable. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, that led to a short time later, I went to special effects to help with building mock-ups. And after being in Imagineering special effects for 6 months, they said, we really like you here. It's like we've got our own art department and art director. In-house, so can you stay? And I said, sure, I love this stuff. I'd been kind of a science geek forever. And so I spent 8 years through Epcot designing special effects. Mm-hmm. And then one really amazing thing about Imagineering is it really, especially at the time, they didn't pigeonhole people. They kind of let people try things out. And somewhere along the line, you know, I'd done some art direction then of little pieces of Epcot just because I was designing special effects for them. And there were a couple jobs that came up, and so I did some designs and contributed, and they said, okay, can you sit in the meeting and, you know, brainstorm with us? And I just got to start doing some show design things. And then I actually won a contest to design this is important to Rex. The they had a contest to design a walk-around robot for Epcot. And they had us all, you know, anybody wanted to get, and I put in designs and I won. I did like several designs. They really liked my design. So we did a little test of a walk around robot and it worked really well at Epcot. He looked sort of like a salt shaker, you know, with a badge on. But it worked out really well. And then we went and bought a completely different robot that they used there, which was much too complicated and died after about a year. So but that was our first experience with a walk. But that, you know, that got me into some meetings. I got to work on Captain EO.
Oh, amazing.
You know, we were doing the initial meetings for that, and we were designing characters and robots and stuff. And so I got to do a little design work on that. And then somewhere in that sequence of, you know, still being in special effects, designing special effects, sitting in the model shop at the time, because we were small. And, you know, this came along this is the key story for Rex. And that is that we all knew that we had been talking about doing a project with George Lucas and Star Wars. And we loved it because there was a lot about Disney and Star Wars and George Lucas that really meshed. You know, there's an awful lot of that even before they were one company that just connected. In the kind of mythology, the stories, the, you know, the values and things. And so we were all excited. We'd all gone to see the film together. We were blown away like everybody else. I'll never forget seeing Star Wars for the first time in Century City and having that huge spaceship come over our heads and the sound effects. And, you know, anyway, we were all enthralled by that. And the idea of doing a project with George Lucas was, you know, incredible. So we heard he was coming. And they were going to show him this idea, and Tony Baxter and Randy Bright and these guys had worked up this idea about doing a simulator ride. So he was there. I think he was there kind of after hours. You know, it was like 5-6 o'clock. A lot of us hung around to see what would happen. And about, you know, 6:30, 7 o'clock, we're all like lurking, you know, down in the hallways. And Tony comes out and said, hey, the meeting went really well. You know, George is real excited about this. We think we might get a project out of this. We might do it. And we got talking about it. He said, oh, by the way, George had an idea. George said to make it less two-dimensional, we should really have a pilot in the simulator. You know, nobody ever had these simulators for, like you said, for military use and also commercial flights. They, you know, you pilot them, but nobody ever done that kind of thing. And they said, yeah. In fact, Tony pulled out this napkin, and here was this little marker drawing on there that George had made. I hope somebody knows where that napkin went.
Gosh.
And it was this little stick figure in front of the screen going, this would make it much more dimensional to create a robot pilot for the thing. And I said, wow, that'd be a great thing. That'd be so cool. And he said, well, why don't you work on some ideas for it? So a bunch of us went off and just on our own, you know, we were, and of course, I mean, God, we were in hog heaven. We were just so excited about the idea of working on anything Lucas. And I can remember, I think I got sick that week. It was, you know, a winter time, and I was at home in bed with a cold and sketching madly. but I brought them in about a week later and everybody gave their sketches to Tony. And, you know, like a few days later, he come found me in the model shop and he said, Chris, they want to build your robot. So I was part of the Star Tours team, and, you know, we had this whole bunch of wonderful designers. Greg Wilsbach was working on the interiors of the simulator. Gil Kepler was working on the exterior and the queue line. I just remember a whole bunch of people that were contributing to this. Tom LaDuke, who was from special effects. He clearly remembers opening a box one day they got and opened it up and pulled some pieces out. Oh, my God, this is C-3PO. You know, it was like we'd open up the Ark of the Covenant. You know,
yeah.
This is one of the pieces because Lucasfilm sent him down to, you know, to.
Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
So So we had a great time working on it. And Rex, you know, we meshed him in. They wrote him in the story, Tom Fitzgerald and the whole team. They worked on how to make that job connect. He actually started out, if you look, I don't know that it's where it's, if it's been published, but he started out as a little different character. He was first called Crazy Harry. And he's going to be the robot that kind of went haywire, you know? Uh-huh. Like he's flying along right and then something goes haywire. And so I designed him with this wild look on his face. And it's like he takes us off on these tangents. Well, gradually that evolved into, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do the rookie pilot who's just learning the ropes. Mm-hmm. And so that's when he became Rex.
Yeah, I was going to ask how close your original sketch that got chosen was to the final Rex that we know.
Pretty close. Yeah,
that's great.
Pretty close. Yeah, the head was about the only difference was that difference in the personality. I first did him mm-hmm. with these two completely different size eyes and this wild look, like he did have a screw loose yes. someplace. but other than that, no, he's basically like one thing I did is I did a lot of different arm positions mm-hmm. With the different ones. I had a couple that were more linear. But I like this with the idea that as the cabin came together and there was the idea that there were going to be controls on the wall and controls in front of him, it was like, oh, he needs a lot of arms to, you know, to get to everything. And
yes.
he's, you know, at the same time. And so that's kind of where the multi-arm swiveling thing came from. I always thought of him as kind of a Swiss Army knife of a robot. You know, his blades
that
come out.
That is a great way to put it.
Every which way to do whatever needs to be done. So
I have a question for you. So what else did you, when you were sick and doing your sketches, what else did you use as inspiration for designing him? Did you look to any sources? Was it just your imagination?
Well, it's never just my imagination. Every design job involves, you know, like everything you've taken into your head for your whole life.
Right.
Consciously or unconsciously. And of course, the Star Wars films were clearly a part of it. Mm-hmm. And every other robot I'd ever seen, you know, it's from television and everything else. So it was all those things. I don't know. And of course he's got a pilot's head. He's, you know, he's got his visor and,
yes.
So he has that kind of woven into him. There wasn't any direct, you know, there wasn't any, it was just kind of that. I think like a lot of things when you're working on mm-hmm. trying to come up with something new, you just take all that stuff that you've accumulated and sleep on it. And something grows out of that. And it grows as you draw, you know, as I drew it and I tried different things. Oh, also, you know, this was the time when, you know, robotic arms were big, you know, they had just become part of manufacturing. You know, we did a big display about robotics at Epcot. Bird and Robot was a great show that Bob Rogers and a company had put together for our GM pavilion. And mm-hmm. it was based on this wonderful idea of creating a character out of a robot arm. In fact, I have a design I did when I was designing the walk around characters for robots for Epcot. I did one that was a rolling around TV antenna. He was like this, you know, on wheels. It was a robot arm basically with an antenna on it that, you know, that drove around and the antenna would look at you and, you know, nod. And it was a little bit like Pixar's lamp, you know?
Yeah. I love that.
It's kind of in the same, I think that idea that the robot arms really had a fascination at the time. So I'm sure that plays into it when you think of like all the arms flailing around and doing things.
I have another question about his design, and it kind of ties into, you know, this first time rookie pilot personality. When did the pull tab come along that I believe it says remove before flight? That's on him. Was that always part of it, or was that kind of added close?
It was added.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very simple. I get a kick out of this now because there's a lot of things on him that are basically from junk stores. Okay. I ran around. We didn't have a whole lot of money for that first Star Wars project. A lot of the other thing I got to do besides designing him was I did work on like the Goose droids. My friend Chris Teets, who is one of the art directors, he'd come up with this idea about using the Goose figures from America Sings, and he had this rough sketch. And so I took that and I like, you know, finalized how the head would work, the binocular eyes and things. And I worked on, we called it the mouse droid that was running around through the, you know, through on the floor and stuff, which was actually, he was like a, a model train underneath this little robot with a lot of toy parts. And we did the conveyor. There was a conveyor in the queue line. It went around with baskets full of parts.
Yep.
Those parts were like from junk stores, costume stores, you know, the junk pile at Mapo, anything we can get. That's what I threw in. Because I did the design on the baskets. And I threw this stuff in there. And so we built them out. Well, and there's a lot of parts on him that literally came from a junk store. There's little brackets and things. And they're literally like from, we had a junk store in Burbank because we had Lockheed so close that was aircraft surplus, you know, so it was aircraft junk from building aircraft. So a lot of details on him were aircraft. So I was roving around through the junk store, picking out parts for things that would work that I could add to him. And I found those remove for four flight tabs. And I just said, that's kind of cool.
I love that.
So when I built the maquette of him, I built a full-size maquette that we used as like an animatic puppet. We actually did somewhere in the Disneyland archives. There's this footage of the original Rex made in foam and foam core and everything else. And he's animating and I'm dressed in black behind him, pushing his arms around, you know,
so we
could see how he could. And anyway, on the mock-up, I used those parts and I stuck that remove before flight thing on it. And it just never left, you know.
I love
that. It's a good inside joke too, because any pilot knows that the whole reason you have that on there is because it ain't ready to fly until that tag is gone. So yeah, it's perfect that it's still stuck. So, you know, I found this for a keychain, this one. So I stuck this one onto the model I have of him. So
I love that. Yeah. And I realize I didn't apologize to our listeners. I realize I didn't provide context because that might not be something everyone's noticed, but RX-24 has a red tab on him that says remove before flight. If you've ever noticed that when my husband and I first began dating, he's Star Wars obsessed. That was his favorite thing to always point out to me. And I would think you told me this every time, but
that's funny. Yeah,
that's cute. Yeah.
The original one was actually one of those aircraft surplus things, you know.
That's great.
And then after that, they printed up a bunch of them, made them, you know, for the different Rexes they built. But the first one was actually surplus.
And before we started the call for our listeners, Chris was sharing with us his purchase from Droid Depot that is a large droid replica of RX-24.
Or DJ Rex.
DJ Rex.
Now at Galaxy's Edge.
Yeah, DJ Rex.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing little guy. I have to get him.
Yeah, let's hear him talk.
Okay, hold on.
DJ Rex. I'm available for all types of events, weddings, Wednesday celebration.
Can you hear him?
Joining,
I can turn any space into a hyperspace.
Just let me know.
I love it. So that is something you could buy Wars Galaxy's Edge.
Yeah.
And also I think at the temporary Galaxy's Edge store at Downtown Disney, I think they have them right now.
Yeah, makes sense.
I hope they do, because now I want
one.
I forgot to mention, besides, he's remote control. You can put him on the floor. My grandsons love this. And you can drive him around. He rolls around. You can push one button. His head goes up and down.
Yeah.
And his arms rotate.
I love it.
And the other thing is he has a function where you turn it on and he will broadcast whatever music you're playing.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you can hook up your iPad to him or iPod. And
absolutely amazing.
You could play the DJ Rex album through
the Oga's Cantina soundtrack from Spotify, cast it on there. And you were mentioning how you love, of course, you love seeing toys or merchandise of a character you designed. It made me think about how you mentioned to us how you designed him from concept to its construction, which is pretty rare. Now, has that always been rare, or just more rare nowadays in Imagineering?
It's more, people are a little more specialized now than they used to be, you know, and the nature of the job is that it involves so many different kinds of trades that you often had to learn something new, which was part of the joy of it for me.
Apparently thrifting was part of the skills you needed.
It's true. Oh yeah, dumpster diving is one of on my resume. Yeah.
Picking
out
the best junk.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's and this is not to say these folks don't, you know, that the generation now doesn't do a lot of similar things.
I'm sure, but with how many the volume of projects that Disney parks have now, I'm sure just everything has to be more streamlined, so more.
Yeah, and so there are more systems and things, but there is some kind of joy I always had in finding something in a dumpster and going, "Oh, this will be perfect." And it changes and it changes your design. You know, you sit there and go, you know, "Oh, this will work. Oh, I'll put it there." In fact, I was kind of jealous when I went through Galaxy's Edge, because I'm looking at all the props going, they got to build these. They got to like take them over to Maple and have them build them custom, you know. I had to go find junk and pieces together.
I'm sure the budget was much larger.
Yeah, just a little bit. Several zeros.
Yes.
So, but yeah. Anyway, the end point was just that, like in my own case, but you know, because I was in the model shop at the time. I wasn't really officially in show design. So I'm working on the design. So I made the model of him, which animated. And then I made the full-size maquette of him, which, like I said, I tested. And then I did production drawings of him because I knew how to draft. And then I gave those drawings, and we brought the full-size mock-up maquette over to Maple. And they literally measured off the full-size one to make the pieces that they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And then they pulled these props I told you about, which I'd literally stuck into the foam or that I made the mock-up at. They literally pulled them off and stuck them on the final version. And then, and then made more or went out to I told them where I got them. So they went to the same, some of the same surplus stores and found some of the pieces. So I got to go all the way through. I also should mention that an awful large, big part of the design was, you know, the crew, you know, the group led by Randy Bright, who was the big proponent of the simulator. And he was our VP of our department for a long time. And Tony Baxter, who led the project, and Tom Fitzgerald, who led the project and was the head writer. And, you know, somewhere along the line, they came up with this beautiful idea of the rookie pilot. And then they did the absolutely perfect selection of Paul Rubens to do the voice. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of things come from that, just like in animation in the film. A lot of the quality of the personality comes out of the voice, what the actor brings to it with their voice. And to this day, I mean, you listen to them, and I'm so glad that they stuck, you know, Paul Rubens' voice on the toy, Pee-wee's voice. That it's a big part of what makes him.
I mean, well, Pee-wee's Big Adventure is my absolute favorite movie of all time. Just want to preference that. I love it. Yeah. And I was so thrilled when I heard that Rex was going to be coming to Galaxy's Edge, because when they announced Galaxy's Edge, I just thought, oh my gosh, I hope like Rex is somehow in it when they announced that. And then my second hope was, oh, I hope Paul Rubens still voices him. So it was very exciting. This is kind of a little off topic. Speaking of Paul Rubens voicing Rex, did you know that Rex made an appearance in Star Wars Rebels?
Only afterwards.
Okay.
Afterwards.
And Paul Rubens voiced him in that. But I just was like, I need to ask if he knew about that appearance.
No, I found out about it. Friends of mine who had kids said, hey, we just watched this and Rex is in it. And I said, you're kidding me. So they said, go on YouTube or wherever you can find it and watch. And I did. And I went, holy cow, he's a TV character now.
Yeah.
So, that's great.
That was a little bit of a little off topic. But going back to the creation of Rex, I would love to hear about its construction, especially if you were having to dumpster dive or thrift to find parts. How did you make multiple Rexes for all of the flight simulators?
Oh, the dumpster. Well, okay. It's actually two things.
Okay.
Okay. So I made the first one. The first one was built out of wood and fiberglass and foam, and the first full-size maquette. We call it a maquette because it was, and it could have been built at any scale, but I just decided there wasn't any reason to scale them down. I might as well build them full size. So I made this one out of foam and wood and so forth. And then I used these props and just stuck them on, said, okay, that's where I want it. And then the MAPO folks figured that they would make the production versions out of aluminum spinnings, where they shape the aluminum into these round shapes, you know, that work really well for him, even the head. So they started to build him. This is the way MAPO did things a lot. You know, now things are created a lot of times in construction drawings, and then you build from the construction drawings with some modification. This was built from scratch. They took my model, set down, said, okay, how are we going to do this? And they started building parts. I made some of the parts. The hands, the hands, I cast the fingers out of fiberglass. I designed them out of wood and then cast them in fiberglass. And I ended up casting some that they used. I think they finally, you know, made them differently. But a lot of the first parts were things that I just made. And then, like I said, they, well, they did things like some of the parts. I literally said, you know, this bracket or this, I got that at Joe Factor Sales up there in Burbank. They went back and bought the whole box full and made that whole first batch. Now, what they've done since is, you know, a lot of times they'll take things like that that might be metal or whatever, and they'll cast a fiberglass version of it. And then they can put that on there and paint it up, and, you know, you'd never know the difference. But yeah, on the first generation, the ones at Disneyland, there were a lot of some of the details of him were literally still the things we'd found at the surplus stores.
Yeah.
How did you feel when you found out, and how did you find out that DJ Rex was going to be in Galaxy's Edge?
I'm trying to remember exactly. I think it was somebody kind of offhand in the hallway someday said, you know, they're going to use it. They're going to put him in there and he's going to be a DJ. I said, you really? Oh, that's kind of cool. And I hadn't heard of that. And then I didn't know too much about it because I was on other teams at the time, working on other projects. But a really interesting thing to me, a really nice thing is we had an event, a company event. I think this was right after I retired and I'd come back in to go to this. And at the end of it, I was over getting coffee and Tom Fitzgerald, you know, that I'd worked with all these years and including on Star Tours. Tom came up to me and said, Chris, I have a story for you. I said, what is it? He said, well, you know, we're going to put Rex in Galaxy's Edge and he's going to be the DJ in the club there. And I said, yeah, I heard that. He says, well, we did a presentation to folks down at Disneyland yesterday. And we walked through all these different things Galaxy's Edge is going to have. It says the biggest applause was when we mentioned that Rex was going to be the DJ in the club.
I mean, of course. We love him.
I thought that's cool. Well, I didn't see, you know, there's that tradition moving over. And yeah, there's a lot of, I could see it. But I, you know, I was thrilled. And it was, I said to Tom, I said, well, I guess we must have done something right, huh?
And, yeah.
So, and I have to tell you, the other thing was to go in and see him. Then the first time I got to visit Galaxy's Edge was so cool. Yeah. Of course, my friend, I got to take my picture standing next to him on the floor there listening to him. And I get a kick out of his patter, and it's so fun. And some of that is on the toy, another plug for the toy.
The episode is not sponsored by the toy, I swear.
Yeah, really. It's,
we just want one.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kidding. The dialogue on this thing is great. I don't know who wrote the dialogue for the toy, but it's brilliant. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. There's a point in it where he says, some of you look familiar. Did you ever go on a ride to Endor? And Paul Rubin's voice is so perfect.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. It's great. Anyway, yeah, it's fun to have that.
I mean, it's so beloved by fans. And we've been in the cantina several times, you know, before Disneyland closed. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing how much applause you would just get on a normal day.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so great if you're in there for a full song cycle. Mm-hmm. And when he breaks down and then comes back, reboots, and then plays the Cantina Band song, just everyone loses their minds.
Everyone cheers. Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I'm curious. I mean, I'm sure most of everything has gone to the archives or been repurposed, but do you have any piece of the original ride or Rex at all?
There's a good question. I don't, there's that. No, I have nothing.
Maybe I shouldn't have asked.
I'm trying to think of that. Actually, I'm sorry. I used to have the head of the maquette. I had it in a box, but I think I finally decided it was too much trouble to drag around. So, let it go. But to a dumpster somewhere so somebody can find it.
Someone can go on a treasure hunt like you did to create him.
Yeah, I did. Actually, in my garage, I have a couple baskets. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I went out and I found some commercial baskets to go on that conveyor and then made graphics for it and we put props inside. But I went through a lot of baskets. So I actually have a couple baskets, one of which is the one that, you know, it's the same one that we used in the conveyor.
Oh, cool.
Holding parts in my garage.
I love that. That's,
but I don't, no, I don't think great. There. I don't think there's anything specific that I. Yeah, I don't. I don't have anything particular. That's, I think, one reason why I got so excited about finding the toys.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's kind of nice to have those parts. You know, to have those around for my own enjoyment.
For sure.
Definitely. Yeah. And do you have any particular stories or favorite memories of the? I mean, you shared some, but any others that you want to share about the construction or opening day or stories from fans that you've heard?
One story I've told a few times is about the day we showed George and Michael Eisner and Frank Wells and the rest of the Disney executives the simulator ride. We actually gave them a ride in the simulator ride. We built a special building that was standing until just recently. They removed it to create a parking structure, and they built a whole new simulator building. Its purpose is to put these simulator type things. And the latest simulator that was in one of these was Avatar, you know, the Avatar ride. Mm-hmm. But we had this building, we just called it the simulator building, big box, really tall, 35 feet tall or something. And we brought the first Rita Fusion simulator over, and then the guys learned to program it. And they set up mock-ups. You know, they had to design the whole camera system for the simulator, and how that film is still an incredible achievement. That first one was film, 70 millimeter film, with this big loop cabinet on the back of the box and this piece of film that was winding and winding and winding on the back and then going underneath the simulator to the camera, to the projector, and then through the projector and then back to the back of the thing. And that was, wow, bouncing around with us the whole time. That is an incredible engineering achievement for the guys at the studio that designed that.
Oh my gosh.
And it was because film at the time was so much better than any video. We actually looked at video to see, and video just was not, at the time, it was not capable of doing a good enough image, mm-hmm, period. We did a side-by-side mock-up, and the mock-up took literally 10 seconds to say, no, if we're going to do film. Yeah. So we built the simulator. The guys worked out how to do the projection system. We built the first cab on top. They, you know, were able to mock things up in there and try them out and, you know, and go ride it, you know, and go, okay, this works, this doesn't. The guys that programmed it too did a phenomenal job. One of the reasons that show is so good is because the program is so exactingly on the film. They're, you know, because they also, it was iterative. They worked up the storyboard. They worked up film sequences. They put them into the thing and they program it and go, you know, this works, but that move doesn't. It doesn't work well. We can't make that move that long. You have to make that dive of the ship only this long because that's all the move we can make physically with the device. Wow. So they had to go back and forth. Anyway, we went through all this effort. We built this first cab. We built, you know, the projection system. And everything else. And we got a day where, you know, we got to go ride it with, like I said, Michael and George to show them the first. They had never seen the simulator, you know, ever ridden on it. So we all climb in into the mock-up seats and we buckle in, and George and Michael and Frank and Dick Nunes and these guys were all like in the back couple rows. And we, Rex was not in there at the time. And we went through like the ride, kind of a animatic of the film, including some, you know, complete pieces. But anyway, we finished, and Frank Wells, the great adventurer who had been to all the continents and climbed all the mountains, you know, and phenomenal guy, he stands up and he's looking very pale. He says, "That's wonderful, but I have to leave. But I am so motion sick. I have got to go." And he says, "Thank you very much." And he gets out. And Dick Nunes says, "Yeah, I'm not feeling too great either." So he gets up. And Michael Eisner goes, "That was fantastic. Can you turn it up?"
Oh, no.
And then Lucas, in his inimitable, quiet way, goes, "Yeah, it'll work." You know?
Yeah. And I mean, that's a compliment.
Yeah, right. And we did it. I think we wrote it again. And they talked about it and about some details about how they were going to do it. And anyway, that was a pretty exciting day to be a part of. And coming out of there, because everybody came out of there going, "This is going to work." You know, that is kind of like the point where everybody knew, okay, all these ideas, you know, the pieces work, but can we make the whole thing work as a whole? And it worked. It worked.
That's
it
great.
And it not only worked, it worked great.
Yeah.
So, and it can, you know, the simulator is capable of going a little faster and, you know, but the, you gotta make it for, every audience, so you can't, because right. It can really throw you around if you wanted to, practically throw you out of the seats. So, and the ride, just like a roller coaster, you want to move a lot, get in the back, you know, it'll fly. And so, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I try to sit in the front.
Isn't it fun? And it's fun to still, it's still fun to do it. It's, every time. In fact, the first day we went to see Galaxy's Edge, my family and I went, did it. And then we went down to ride Star Tours and a little short while later, and we came up and said, that's still pretty darn good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It sure is.
It's a great show. It's just, you know, and the later iterations are a lot of fun, and it's even got more tricks than it did.
It still has really long lines, even up to when we were. Yeah, for sure.
It's a really good ride.
I mean, can always tell by how long the line is.
I mean, obviously with the 3D glasses, with the current iteration, it is a little different. But the first time I wrote it, I thought, it's so wild to think that the original one didn't have 3D glasses, and this doesn't feel that much different.
It's true.
Like, the effects worked so well, even without the 3D glasses. So that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We felt immersed when I was a kid. I wrote it when I was a kid, and I was definitely scared. I was like, oh, I'm really here.
And part of that is the way they filmed it, the way they put that film together was brilliant. And you know, you can create a lot of the illusion of depth in the film. You know, we often, you notice that 3D films have their special purposes, but for the most part, they haven't spread to take over. Whereas I even have a 3D TV, you know, they were selling those a few years back, and I hardly ever use it. It's because we can get a very strong illusion without that stereoscopic capability. It does add, that's a good use of it there to me. It adds a nice element, but it's not the key element. It's the brilliance of the story and the combination of the movement and the experience. And George was absolutely right. Having the pilot in front of it was, it makes it more dimensional as well.
Yeah. So it gives it that one extra level of feeling like you're in it.
Right. He ties to the film. He ties to us. It's, you know, one more amazing Lucas idea right there. So
he's great as a character bringing you into the ride because he's so endearing and makes so many mistakes. And you just feel like you can relate to him and you're mad at him for going off course. And if you're a kid like I was, it's like, please get us to safety.
Yes, for sure. It's true. And, in fact, we had, a couple of years ago, they did kind of retrospective in one of our magazines. I think it might be in D23, the magazine. But I remember getting interviewed by our PR folks, and they asked that question: why do you think his attraction has been so strong? I had to think about it for a while, but I thought, it's because he's all of us. We all kind of identify with the rookie that's climbing in and going, oh my God, I hope I can do this right. And so I think that's a part of what makes him so good. And Paul Rubens perfectly embodied that in the way he did the voice. So
adding comedy to the adventure is just so brilliant because it just brings families together because everyone has something they can enjoy about it.
If you think about it, I mean, that's been the strength of a lot of the most classic Disney attractions like Haunted Mansion and Pirates. You know, their sense of humor it's part of what makes them magic. You know, you come out of there, you've been scared, you've been, thrown around a little bit you've also laughed and along with the characters. So,
yes, exactly.
All those emotions.
You've worked on so many amazing attractions at various Disney parks. Would you say that Rex is one that continues to be most dear to your heart, or is there something about him particular that, has made it so special for you and your family?
Well, we have another connection. You might remember in the original show, you walk into the little waiting area right next to the simulator. And the film comes out, tells you about buckling your seatbelt and all that. That's my family.
Oh, is it really? Yeah, yeah.
Like I said, our budgets were not too big.
Wow.
So what we did was nowadays, I don't know that they do this anymore, but we used to, like, Imagineers used to provide the voices. I was always goes into Space Mountain, and I'd listen to the various, you know, people talk in the queue.
Yeah.
The, communicators and space, you know, astronauts and all. And it's all friends of mine. I go, that's Ed. That's, wow. You know, same, we did that everywhere. And the same thing was true. We needed to create this film. They said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have you guys be part of it. So so I brought my kids in. A lot of people on the team brought their kids in. And Jenny Mulholland, the coordinator who became a great Shield producer, she's the one with her the bagels on her head, you know, the Princess Leia haircut. And my friend's daughter puts things under the seat. And there were two kids who take a picture of Chewbacca, and Chewbacca almost tears their head off. That's my sons. That's my two sons.
Wow.
Who are now in their 40s, right? But Patrick and Nick were there, and I was sitting behind them, and my wife was in there too. And anyway, they filmed them, and the hilarious thing was, we have the outtakes of this. They had it set up so Nick was encouraging his older brother to take a picture of Chewbacca. And for some reason, maybe because the older boy, Patrick, was a little stage struck or something, mm-hmm. he kept having problems firing the camera. He couldn't get it to flash. It just, and you know, it was driving. And Chewbacca, at one point, there's a great take where he fouls up for about the 20th time. And Chewbacca starts to lean forward like he's just going to strangle the kid, you know?
Oh, it's my like, gosh.
You got to get me out of this suit, you know? And then the director, who was a friend of mine, you know, called me over and said, you know, I think I want to try switching him because I'm watching your younger son and he just really hams it up. He seems like he. So we switched seats, and Patrick encouraged Nick to do it. And Nick got it on the first take. He just turned around. What you saw was like the first take. And they took a couple
That's
more.
Amazing.
But the first take, he got it. And Chewbacca, rah, you know, and all this. And that was in there until we, you know, till that day we, you know, took it out and went for the second generation show. In fact, we had this special event where the last night they had us come in and share with the folks at Disneyland just about the history of the ride, a bunch of us who'd worked on it. And I brought my sons in, and they got mobbed afterwards. I said, yeah, they're here. They said, oh, they're here. And they stood up. And of course, they were in their 30s then. And it's like, wow, look at this.
That's great.
I think that's one of the few times they've had to sign autographs. But yeah, so it was a family thing. And I have to finish by saying, so that video was all employees and their families. Mm-hmm. And we all got paid a bag lunch with a soda and a cookie.
Oh my gosh. That's hilarious that now, because I saw casting calls on like casting networks for pre-shows for Galaxy's Edge. And I'm like, they're union casting calls.
Yeah, exactly. We don't do things like that anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
oh my
great.
Gosh.
Too bad. We'd still be getting residuals.
Right? Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that story so much.
It was so much fun. And I have, you know, I have a copy of it on video someplace.
I love it. And I'm sure it lives forever on YouTube.
Yeah, it's probably in there, but they got a kick out of always going in, going, look, that's us. Or you know,
that's
these friends
great.
Going, that's you up there. Crazy. So all in the family. Part of what made it magic was it was literally a family operation. So
that's wonderful. I love that.
And Rex is part of the family too.
I love that. And now you have like a decent sized version
size.
That talks.
And he animates and he talks. It's just, And so what do you have to say, Rex?
That was very appropriate.
That was perfect. That was a perfect way to cap this off.
I think those are kind of random too. That's pretty good that he picked did the right one.
Yeah.
You know, the characters make a place, mm-hmm. right? I remember at Epcot when we opened up Epcot, and I'd spent months and years watching the design come together and seeing all the architecture. But Epcot World Showcase came to life when the people from the different countries were there operating them. And you were working with German kids and Japanese kids and Chinese kids and Moroccan kids. And, you know, that brought it to life. And the same thing is now when I go to Galaxy's Edge, I mean, the last time, one of the highlights of being in there was R2-D2 was there.
Yeah.
And the kids just, it was so much fun talking to him. And had this wonderful moment where Chewbacca and Rey were there talking with us and some kids and taking pictures. And a couple of stormtroopers came around the corner. And so, of course, then it's time for Chewbacca to disappear. So they start to leave. And some kid grabbed Chewbacca's leg with this big hug and wouldn't let him go. And Chewbacca, you can see this look on Chewbacca's face like, I have to go. Anyway, it was so much fun. It just, it brings the place to life. The, you know, the people, the personalities of people bring it to life. And
yeah, you know, agreed.
Yeah. So.
And the droids. The droids bring it to life, too.
Yeah. Exactly. It's, yeah. They're, because they're, if you think about it, that's one of the genius parts of Star Wars from the beginning is, you know, R2-D2 and C-3PO and those characters are much a part of the heart of it. The warmth of it is everything else. I love those too.
Yeah, we love the droids.
I have a little wind-up C-3PO around here somewhere. He's about yay tall, you know, 4 inches tall. And you wind him up and he goes, thunk, 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 thunk.
Oh, my gosh.
I have to oil him once in a while because he gets a little rusty. But, yeah,
he's
part of my collection, too.
Well, now I need to add that DJ Rex to our collection. We have the R2-D2 one from Galaxy's Edge. We definitely need him, too.
Isn't that a great start? Not to turn this into a commercial
thing. I know.
But
I know.
One of my favorite parts about going there is that I brought some friends there, and we had the best hour as they picked out parts and made their robot and then took it over and had the guy energize it for them.
Yeah.
I just thought it was brilliant. You know, it was just brilliant. You know, I didn't make one yet. I'm going to go back and make one. I was.
Yeah, I haven't either.
My daughter chose to do that for her 5th birthday in January of 2020, which I can't believe is already a year ago. But she loves her droid.
That's
well,
cool.
Thank you so much for talking about this. This was so great. As you know, a lifelong fan of RX-24, it was so great to get to hear these stories about him. We so appreciate you
and
sharing about that.
Everything that you've worked on, we would love to have you back sometime to talk about other projects that you have worked on. That would be fascinating.
I especially want to talk about Monsters, Inc., since that was my first job, being an attractions cast member.
I'm so blessed that I got to work on the one here and the work in the one in Japan. And to me, again, Boo and Sully and Mike, they're like my family. Because I literally spent months with them, physically working on those things. So, and I got to meet Pete Docter and the guys that worked on it, created that. We were also, amazing people to know. So, I feel very blessed by having these experiences, and it's my pleasure to share them.
Yes. Well, let's please have a Monsters, Inc. future episode with you. I would love that.
I would love doing that.
Now, I don't know if you have any that you want to share, but do you have any socials or website or anything like that that you want to share?
Some people
I wasn't sure, so I just thought I would check just in case.
You can find me if you look up, I guess it's just my name on Facebook or something.
There we go. And you can find me at The Healthy Mouse on Instagram or on Twitter, healthy_mouse. And then, of course, you can find our podcast socials at Cartoons to Castles on Instagram and just Cartoons Castles on Twitter. And Melanie, where can people find you?
Yes, I am Keep Quirky on Instagram and Keep Quirky OC on Twitter. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us. It's been awesome.
Yes, thank you so much.
Pleasure was mine.
Hey, sorry, folks. I'm sure to do better next time. It was my first flight, and I'm still getting used to my programming. Hey!
Thanks for listening.
Till next time, keep dreaming.